You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
This is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. There are a slew of elections across Latin America this year, and some observers are predicting a reverse of the so-called pink tide, the turn toward the left that marked much of the region about a decade ago. But to what degree are voters turning right, and to what degree are they just turning against the status quo? That's a question we can ask about El Salvador's legislative and municipal elections, which took place on March 4th. Back in 2009, the FMLN, the guerrilla group turned political party, won El Salvador's presidency for the first time. The party's held it since then. But in the latest election...
I think what happened in general was that the FMLN hardcore voter didn't go to vote.
That's Hector Silva Avalos, an American University research scholar, founder of Revista Factum, an investigator for Insight Crime. He explains that the conservative opposition didn't necessarily make gains so much as the FMLN suffered losses. But first, on March 11th, Chile inaugurates a new president when center-right Sebastián Piñera replaces center-left Michelle Bachelet. My colleague Elizabeth Gonzalez spoke with New York University's Patricio Navia about what will and won't change and what Piñera needs to accomplish in his first 100 days.
Well, thank you, Patricio, again for taking the time to speak to me. We spoke before the election in Chile, and now we are about to start the new administration.
Yes, we are. And things are looking pretty optimistic for the new government. The conditions, the international conditions, are better than what people expected, despite all the turmoil. Piñera is now on a better footing than he was 8 years ago when he first became president. This time around, there hasn't been an earthquake, and he doesn't need to replace a president who left last time with 80% approval. This time around, people are looking forward to having Michelle Bachelet leave office. Her approval is in the 30s, so the conditions are much easier for Sebastián Piñera.
Yeah, that's exactly some of the things I'd like to talk to you about today, especially because Sebastián is about to take office March 11th. This is his second shot at the presidency, as you mentioned. The first one was in 2010 to 2014. And just like it was back then, he was replacing Michelle Bachelet. And I'd also like to talk about how this shift to the right in the government in Chile might be reflective of what's going on in the rest of the region. So can you tell me a little bit more about why this new takeover from a Bachelet to Piñera government is different from what it was in 2010?
Sure, there are a couple of things that are different. In 2010, Piñera was the first right-wing president to take power since the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet ended in 1990. Now, the reference to Piñera's presidency is going to be Piñera's first presidency. No one talks about Pinochet and the dictatorship anymore. And that's a positive development for Chile and an easier challenge for Piñera. He needs to live up to the expectations of what he did in his first presidency when the conditions were much more difficult for him. This time around, his right-wing coalition has experience in government. There isn't the Pinochet shadow, and the economic conditions are slightly better. Now, it is a right-wing turn, as in the rest of Latin American countries, but we do need to remember that Chile's left-wing government was also more moderate than other left-wing governments in Latin America. In fact, tomorrow, Chile will sign the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership Agreement, and that's a left-wing government. So in terms of market-friendly policies, Piñera will probably be a bit more market-friendly than Bachelet was, but Chile is not by any means on the same track as other Latin American countries that are closed to market-friendly policies. Chile has embraced market-friendly policies ever since the transition to democracy in 1990, and that will not change under Piñera.
So you don't think that this falls in the same line with, for example, Mauricio Macri being elected in Argentina, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski in Peru, and some of the polls of the elections this year, which suggests that a right-wing government could take over in Costa Rica, Brazil, even Colombia. You think Chile is different from those cases?
Well, I would challenge your assessment. I don't think there was that much change in Peru with Pedro Pablo Kuczynski's election. The economic policies that Ollanta Humala had implemented, despite his left-wing rhetoric, the economic policies were very market-friendly. In fact, it's difficult to identify economic policy changes that PPK brought into the government. So Argentina certainly experienced a right-wing shift. I mean, there is no question about that. The government that it's living in Costa Rica is a moderate centrist government, not a left-wing government. So I would say, yes, we do see a right-wing shift in some Latin American countries. In Argentina, it's very radical, but in most other countries, there has been more continuity in terms of economic policies. To be sure, Sebastián Piñera will be more market-friendly than Michelle Bachelet was. And in her last administration, her second administration, Bachelet oftentimes seemed to think that the solutions to Chile's problems always went through the state, to government sector solutions. Piñera will probably place a bigger emphasis on private sector solutions, and that's going to be a significant departure from Bachelet. But Chile wasn't that far to the left to begin with, and thus there is a right-wing shift, but Chile was already pretty market-friendly under Bachelet.
One of the things that we also saw in this election was that even though this, you know, the moderates ultimately ended up winning, we did see a more activist left gain some power in the Congress, right? And so even though the Chile Vamos coalition of Piñera got more seats than any other party, they are going to have to contend with a much stronger Frente Amplio, which was the party of the third place candidate, Beatriz Sánchez. How does that affect Piñera's agenda?
Right. So the opposition is going to be more fragmented. We're going to have the traditional moderate left-wing opposition, the old Concertación, now called Nueva Mayoría, that will probably split into two groups, one with the centrist Christian Democrats and the other with the socialist, communist, and PPD parties. And then to the far left, you're going to have the Frente Amplio with 20 legislators in the Chamber of Deputies and one senator. So they are significant. They are not huge, but they are significant, and they will probably further deepen the division within the left-wing opposition. You're going to have two wings in the left-wing opposition, one that is going to be moderate, the other one is going to be radical. Piñera will have the possibility to bargain with the moderate opposition to pass the legislation he wants to pass. So that's going to give him an opportunity. But the radical opposition, particularly the Frente Amplio, will probably want to take to the streets and block Piñera's reforms, and that's going to generate some social tensions. So in terms of legislation, it will be an advantage for Piñera because he's going to have a moderate opposition to bargain with, and he will be able to pass legislation. But in terms of social tensions, the more radical opposition will probably want to take to the streets and make life difficult for Piñera. However, what's good for Piñera is that Chileans, for the most part, are moderate. So if the opposition moves far to the left, then Piñera will have an opportunity to gain the support of the of Chileans, of the people, that are way more moderate than the radical left-wing opposition wants to make the country go towards.
And so what do you see are the more contentious sort of reform items that Piñera has planned that would, you know, come into contradiction with more extreme left?
So there will be three big issues for Piñera's first 100 days. He needs to pass a pension reform. This is something that Bachelet attempted to pass but failed to. Chile has a private savings pension account system, so everyone has their own pension savings account managed by private companies. Chileans contribute with 10% of their salaries to those pension savings accounts that they can only withdraw from when they retire at age 60 for women and 65 for men. There is widespread agreement that the percentage of savings needs to increase. It needs to go from 10 to 15 gradually. So Piñera will be able to do that. But the question is, who will manage those funds, the private pension system or a public pension system? Bachelet wanted a public pension system like the U.S.'s social security system. Piñera wants to give that money to the private pension funds. He will probably have enough support in Congress to carry out his objective, but he's going to have to spend tap into government resources to increase the pensions of people that are now retired. So there will have to be some compromise there. The second big issue is going to be the tax reform that Bachelet passed in 2014 and that needed some fixing in 2015. Piñera will have to fix that tax reform again to introduce more incentives for investment and job creation while keeping tax revenues at the same level. He will have some support from the opposition and from the moderate opposition to do that, but he needs to be creative in finding ways of introducing more incentives for investment while keeping the tax revenues at the same level and sort of introducing a bit more fiscal responsibility. And the third issue where Piñera will have big problems is educational reform, particularly at the university level, because Bachelet introduced legislation for an unfunded reform that would guarantee free university education to about 60% of Chilean college students. There is no funding for that, but that's in the legislation now, and Piñera needs to either find funding for that or modify that legislation. And since the radical left-wing coalition is comprised mostly of former university student leaders, they are going to be the strongest opposition to Piñera going back on Bachelet's reform that guarantees free education for 60% of the lowest income, or for the 60% of Chileans among those with the lowest income. That's going to be difficult for Piñera, and I expect that to be Piñera's biggest headache in the next one, in the first 100 days.
Now, one issue that you didn't bring up, but that the Interior Minister, for example, recently said would be a priority for the government is immigration reform. One of the things, as we know, upsetting the social order and geopolitics worldwide are these massive migration waves. In Latin America, we have the Venezuelans, Haitians, even Cubans. And Chile recently has been absorbing more and more of that Latin American migration. Now, Chileans generally think that immigration is good for the country, but according to a Cadem poll, 78% believe that the last government did not know how to handle it. How important do you think this is for Chileans, and what would we expect from Piñera?
Well, it is a big issue for people. I mean, there is a big debate as to how many immigrants are coming. So immigration is going to be an issue for Piñera because people are worried about immigration. About 15 years ago, 2% of people in Chile were immigrants. Now it is 5%. So the immigrant population has grown rather rapidly over the past few years, and there isn't really a good regulation in place to take or to structure the arrival of immigrants. Now, most of that will depend on Piñera's administrative decisions. So he doesn't need to go to Congress for that. There are things that the government can do through executive orders to fix the immigration problem. And I think Piñera will do that. It's going to be a contentious issue, but as you said, the majority of Chileans are in favor of some kind of immigration reform. And thus, it shouldn't be that difficult for Piñera to pass that immigration reform given that most of what he needs to do is through executive decrees, and he can do that without going through Congress. But it's going to be a big issue. The good thing for Piñera is that there is widespread support for him to take action on regulating the arrival of immigrants. Particularly with Haitians, the number of Haitians coming to Chile has increased very, very rapidly. And there are suspicions, justified suspicions, that most Haitian immigrants are coming into Chile as tourists, and then they overstay their visas. So there has to be some kind of regulation so that the immigrants that come to Chile come as immigrants and not as tourists who overstay their visas.
Yeah, it's been over 100,000 that enter within just 2017. Is that right?
That's right. And I mean, you can see many more immigrants in Chile today. Again, the overall percentage of the population that is immigrant in Chile, it's close to 5%. So it's still below many other Latin American countries. But it has grown so rapidly in the past few years that it has become a sort of public policy issue and a political issue. And Piñera talked about that in his campaign, and he said he would take action, and the majority of Chileans are in favor of taking that action. We haven't seen many attacks on immigrants in Chile, and many immigrants are in fact assimilating into Chilean society. So I think Piñera has ample room to fix the problem without it becomes a much bigger problem as it is in other countries.
And talking about some other social issues that are a legacy of the Bachelet government, for example, her fixes to the gender equality, right? She implemented the 40% quota for party lists. And just this week, she introduced a new constitution that would eliminate that gender pay gap that exists. Do you see any future for that in Piñera's government?
Well, Bachelet's new constitution, she proposed a whole new constitution for Chile a week before she left office. That's going to go nowhere, and it's kind of irresponsible on her part to try to introduce constitutional reform a week before leaving, and not just constitutional reform. She wants a whole new constitution. Piñera will probably come in and just shelve that and forget about it, and Chileans are going to remain with Pinochet's constitution that has been reformed many times, several times even under Bachelet. So I don't think the constitutional issue will go anywhere. But social issues will continue to make progress as Chile develops. Bachelet passed an abortion legislation, legalizing abortion under three very specific conditions. That's already in place, and Piñera will not revert that. Pay gap is a big issue in Chile. I don't think it will go through a constitutional reform, but there will continue to be pressure to equalize the pay levels of men and women for the same kind of work they do in different professions. That's already the case in government salaries. So there is already a move towards equalizing salaries among men and women. And there are other issues as well, the issue of gender identity. Chile just won an Oscar for the best foreign film on a film about a transgender person, a transgender woman. And now, just yesterday, the Senate finally passed a legislation to regulate how transgender persons can actually change their birth assigned sex. And that's significant progress. Piñera will not revert that, but we continue to see that gradual progress in Chile with some contentious issues, because these are contentious issues themselves everywhere. But there will continue to be social progress, in my view.
Now, wrapping up here, I'd just like to bring it back to a point that you mentioned earlier, that Bachelet will be signing also before she leaves the new TPP-11 deal, which is now the Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, which leaves out the United States. How does Piñera feel about this CPTPP agreement?
I think there is widespread agreement in Chile in favor of free trade deals. Both the right and the left have promoted them, and Piñera will continue to champion that. So I think Chile, despite its relatively small size, will continue to be a leader in Latin America in promoting free trade agreements. Piñera will probably want to focus a bit more in consolidating trade with other Latin American countries, particularly Argentina now, that is whose government is ideologically close to Piñera, and also with Peru and probably Mexico, depending on what happens there. Chile has been a leader in Latin America in terms of free trade agreements, and the country will continue to be a leader, especially now that an even more market-friendly president is coming to power.
And do you think that Piñera will be able to champion more regional integration, Latin America, for example, with the Pacific Alliance and Mercosur? Is that, do you think, a priority?
That's going to be Piñera's priority. I mean, the Pacific Alliance was Piñera's priority in his first administration. Now, things will depend a bit on what happens with the presidential elections in Colombia and Mexico. So if the right wins in those countries, then there will be more opportunities. If the left wins in both countries, then Piñera's attempt will probably find some resistance in Colombia and Mexico. But depending on what happens in the region, Piñera will be able to push forward his agenda. His agenda is pro-trade and pro-integration in all dimensions. He did that in his first administration, and he's going to want to do that again. Everything will depend on what happens in other countries.
And in terms of reaching out to Mercosur, is there also some hesitation there depending on Brazil's electoral outcome?
Right. Brazil is not part of the Pacific Trade Alliance. It's part of Mercosur. The election is in October, and depending on who wins there, then Piñera will move into closer integration with Mercosur. But if the left wins in Brazil, probably Brazil will not be open to more integration with other countries that have freer trade policies than Brazil.
Okay. Thank you so much, Patricio.
My pleasure.
That was Patricio Navia speaking with Elizabeth Gonzalez. Now we turn to El Salvador, where the country held local elections on March 4th. What do they tell us about prospects for next year's presidential election? I'm Karen Zissis, and I got some answers from Hector Silva Avalos. So to start off, the governing FMLN lost a large number of seats, as I understand it, to the conservative Arena Party. In this year of elections across the Americas, there's been talk of the region turning back the pink tide and turning more conservative. And I wanted to get a better understanding of, in the case of El Salvador, do you see that being the case? And can you explain what's behind the FMLN's losses and Arena's gains?
What we had were municipal and legislative elections on Sunday, March 4th. And it's an important one because it happens more than a year before the presidential election. So as any other midterm election, this was not also some sort of test of the Sánchez-Arena presidency, the FMLN incumbent right now, but also kind of a prologue to what's going to happen in the presidential election. The FMLN went in to this election with the polls against them, in part because of the president is highly unpopular. The situation of violence, keep in mind that El Salvador is still one of the most violent places in the world. Mm-hmm. And then there was the issue of corruption, which I don't think was the most important one, but since the previous FMLN administration, that of President Mauricio Funes, corruption became more and more a thing for voters, I think. And that, the FMLN is also, the FMLN government and the FMLN's administration was seen as a more corrupt administration. So, and the outcome was not good for the FMLN. At the end of the day, as we're speaking, we don't have a final result statement, but we're pretty clear that the FMLN is going to lose some 8 seats in Congress, and Arena is going to win some 3 or 4 seats. And that combined means that the FMLN will lose the magic number of 29 deputies or Congress seats. Mm-hmm. El Salvador has an unicameral Congress of 84 seats. So 29, it's kind of the magic number to prevent absolute majority. Mm-hmm. So the FMLN won't have that. And with that, Sánchez Serén will enter his last year with the opposition led by Arena with the capacity of blocking everything for the president. So that, yes, that will give Arena and the right, because also two smaller parties, the GANA and the PCN, right-wing parties, won seats. So it's going to be a huge block of the right, which is probably going to block the FMLN in terms of approving loans, approving budget, but also probably that block will have the capacity of bringing in ministers to impeach them.
One of the things I thought was interesting is there was a loss of the mayorship in San Salvador. So the FMLN lost the mayorship in San Salvador. Can you explain what happened there?
Yeah. Actually, that was the other loss. And as I said, this was a legislative and municipal election. Mm-hmm. And there, in the municipal side, the FMLN experienced an important loss, too. It wasn't just the city of San Salvador, but of course, that was the most important one. Not just because they lost the capital city, but because San Salvador had played a role in the FMLN outcome of the overall FMLN health in political terms. And that's because of the current mayor of San Salvador, Nayib Bukele, who won the mayor, the city hall as an FMLN member, as an FMLN candidate. But he wasn't picked by the FMLN as its candidate for re-election, which was really a very, you know, non-intelligent move in political terms, because Mr. Bukele is a very popular major. But it seems now that Mr. Bukele, who after being ejected from the FMLN, created his own movement that now he's turning into a political party, and it's been known that Mr. Bukele has had presidential ambitions because he's so popular, and it seemed like the FMLN wasn't thinking about him. So they broke up, and this really badly hit the FMLN. So now Mr. Bukele and his people are trying to attribute the loss in San Salvador to this breaking, but I don't think that's the case. I think, of course, a lot of the FMLN voters were hoping that Bukele was going to be the candidate for mayor again. But the loss is not just in San Salvador. The FMLN lost traditional strongholds that they had. The losses were everywhere. They're just keeping two provincial capitals after having a lot of them. They lost traditional strongholds, small towns that were guerrilla. Keep in mind that the FMLN was before being a party, you know, the guerrillas that fought the government in the 80s. And when there were a guerrilla, they had the small towns or medium-sized towns as strongholds that they had never lost, as Tecoluca in San Vicente. They lost it for the first time ever to Arena. The loss is nationwide. In the case of San Salvador, Bukele played a role, of course. They put a candidate, a woman who, she's an honest politician, but she was not a good candidate. And you know, in some places, the loss was big. I was actually in San Salvador last week, and I saw that on Sunday, on election day, the FMLN lost 3-1 in some polling places. Wow. in San Salvador. So it was pretty big. I think what happened in general was that the FMLN hardcore voter didn't go to vote, you know, and because of a number of factors. They weren't happy with the candidate. They weren't happy with the leadership, which is a 30-year-old leadership, calling the shots all over again. They weren't happy with the corruption accusations. They weren't happy in general with the state of the government. These are hardcore FMLN voters. They didn't go out. They didn't vote for Arena, but they didn't vote for the party. again, with the numbers not final yet, it seems like just in the legislative vote, the FMLN lost 500,000 votes, and that's a lot.
Yeah. Do you see, in particular, in rural areas, a reason why that would happen, that in terms of rural versus urban? Because that's very interesting what you're saying. Is there something about the way campaigning happened in rural areas, or is there something about the way that information was being shared in rural areas that caused FMLN voters to decide not to turn out?
Yeah, I think there's a difference. I think in the case of San Salvador and the city in the outskirts of San Salvador, Santa Tecla, Antiguo Cuscatlán, and some of those, you need to think like small Mexico cities or small Latin American capitals with all, you know, the world connections, the online connections. It's a better informed voter. And then now there's alternative media in El Salvador. There's a lot of campaigning through social networking. Nayib Bukele is a heavy presence in social networking. So in the cities, in the main cities, all these accusations and all, you know, of corruption, of incompetence were clear. In the rural areas, I think there are two factors. One is that, again, the FMLN is a really heavy presence, but the power for control of the territorial structures of the party has been ongoing since the war. And this leadership kind of took over that political structure. So newcomers from the party in rural areas felt like they didn't have a spot, they didn't have a chance, and they were not going to vote to the candidates that the cúpula or the leadership was naming. So the internal fights, the internal feuds had a lot to do. And the second thing of the second part of this is governing. I think, you know, despite the FMLN has done some things in the social area due to incompetence, that blocking of the opposition, violence, but incompetence has a lot to do with it. People in the rural areas were not feeling any benefits from government programs. That was a part of it.
Mm-hmm. One thing I saw in from a poll prior to the election is that Salvadorans have little confidence in the electoral agency. How did the process go this time?
Yeah, that's an important one. That's an important issue. And in general, you know, confidence on the tribunal, Tribunal Supremo Electoral, the electoral tribunal has not, historically hasn't been the best, but it was healthy. I think what happened is in 2015, the electoral system changed, the electoral process, because the Supreme Court ruled in favor of a more open vote. So people was able not to vote just for a party, but for a list of faces. So you could vote for a face of one party or in the candidate of another party, and you could, you know, but with your vote, change the order of the lists. So in 2015, that was an issue because it meant, you know, more names on the ballot, wider ballots, a very complex process of scrutiny. So the tribunal showed itself really incompetent. So there were a lot of questions about that. So the tribunal came into this election with that shadow. But I was there, as I said, electoral weekend, and they were pretty swift. I mean, the process was still complex. And they just kind of made a huge mistake in the case of San Salvador, mixing up the order of the names. So all of that don't bring confidence to the process. But And yes, this is another thing. The outcome, the final outcome of voters was low. My understanding is that it's not going to turn out as the lowest in history. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, it's going to be pretty much in the low end of average. So I don't think that the lack of trust in the tribunal, which exists, will end up being a determining factor in the election. I think it has more to do with the internal feuds of the FMLN and the reasons that to which the loss of the FMLN could be attributed to, not necessarily the lack of confidence in the electoral authority.
Interesting. So it sounds more like discontent with the offerings rather than with the institutions.
Yes. I am certain of that. I mean, the collapse in votes for the FMLN, it's not because of lack of confidence in the electoral authority or system. It's because of the party's problems.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I noticed is that security and violence counted as top concerns for voters. And I think it's interesting you touched on corruption as well. We're looking at some similar top voter concerns in El Salvador that you see in other Latin American countries. But in the case of El Salvador, there has been a decrease in the homicide rate. I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about why violence continues to be a top concern for voters, if you can give us some broader context about that issue.
Well, yes, homicides have come down, but it's still a very bad, violent country. And in some communities, it is still an uncontested truth that gangs rule the territories. And that means violence, not just violence in the form of homicides, but in the form of extortion, of a lack of the rights of mobility, of sexual violence, and all that. So my take is that some voters blame the FMLN for not being capable of dealing with the problem, mm-hmm. which voters have blamed Arena or the right in the past because of that. But here's a very personal take on this. The FMLN decided that they were going to go really heavy against gangs, and they were going to bet on an open war against gangs. And that took them to a really heavy, harsh policy that involved even extrajudicial killings. But not just the killings, but a lot of harassment in these communities by the police and a state of fear. Of course, the communities blame the gangs, but also now they blame the government. The gangs are not invalid. The government is. So I think there was a vote of punishment there also because of that in some communities, especially in suburban San Salvador.
When you think about it, it's a little bit chilling because it makes you see how there's an alarming parallel with the past. I don't know what you think of that. Just that if you think of a country with a history of civil war, where the government played a certain role, and now we're seeing this party that opposed that government now being in that role of harassing in communities. It's sort of like a role reversal in a way.
Yes, of course. And this is an issue that goes way beyond the election. And, I think the FMLN, it's something that needs to be analyzed on how this policy or this approach caused the election to, or was a part of the reasons that caused the FMLN the election. But yes, now you will have a lame duck president and a lame duck government that will have to deal with this problem one more year. And their approach so far has been these kind of policies. Like in some cases, you can even say scorched earth. Mm-hmm. Just a very open permissiveness to the disrespect of basic human rights of the population. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that took a toll on them. I'm not saying that RN is going to have a different approach. And it's interesting that the major that won the election for Arena is a guy that openly negotiated with the gangs back in 2014. I'm not saying that's bad per se, but they negotiated not in terms of trying to end violence or enhance rehabilitation or prevention programs, but in electoral terms. Mm-hmm. And the bargain was, okay, you give me votes because you control the territories, and I give you either municipal power or openness for you to conduct your criminal enterprises. So yeah, violence is of course, in the campaign, nobody talked about it. Mm-hmm. The parties weren't interested in going into these complex situations that don't have easy solutions. I mean, you saw a couple of candidates talking about nonsense about death penalties and all that. Mm-hmm. And there's something very important to be said here, Karen. Arena didn't do well. The Arena vote was low. I don't think it will end up being the lowest ever in, or the lowest in history, but it's going to be in the top five or in the bottom five. You know, they lost some 150,000 votes, which is bad. The problem is that the FMLN lost twice that or three times that. But Barena didn't do well in the polls. Another thing to be said is that when you look at into the names of the candidates that the people chose, some of the candidates that were pointed out for having possible connections with corruption or organized crime were left out, especially in some of the cities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's an issue. It's not Guatemala, in which, you know, corruption is a very heavy issue in the public agenda and for civil society. But in El Salvador, you know, this kind of conversation is taking, it's now being stronger.
Mm-hmm. What role do you see there being any impact from the White House's decision to suspend TPS, temporary protected status for Salvadorians? Has it played a role in these elections? And how do you see it playing a role as we're entering this period with, as you put it, a lame duck president?
Listen, I don't think that decision per se, I mean, again, I think the TPS thing adds up to the general conception of this being an incompetent government, an incompetent administration. You cannot deal with violence. You cannot deal with diplomacy. You cannot bring us back TPS. You cannot deal with abuses coming from the state. You cannot deal with the fiscal crisis. You cannot deal with the opposition. You are not a good administration. I think the TPS adds up to that. I think it's an important enough issue for Salvadorans. But, you know, Salvadorans, I think, saw TPS as they saw other number of issues as the government didn't do enough. The government didn't do well here. Uh-huh. Of course, you know, as in every country, as in every democracy, you cannot put all the blames in the executive branch. But then again, you are the executive branch, and the FMLN has very keen to blame elsewhere, put the blames elsewhere. They're doing that as we speak when seeking who's responsible for this, for their loss. One of their most important leaders told a reporter, the reporter asked, whose fault is this? And the leader blamed the reporter, said, you are. You know, and it's kind of, you know, just an example on how this old leadership kind of, I think, appeared to the electorate as unfit to rule, so to speak. So at the end of the day, the TPS was another addition to the list of things that they could not handle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. It sounds like we're looking a little bit at a rejection of status quo.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Hector. That was a great overview.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Latin American Focus. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Gonzalez, and I'm your host, Karin Zissis. For more on this year's elections in Latin America, visit www.as-coa.org/2018. The music in this podcast was recorded at an America Society concert. Visit musicoftheamericas.org for more information about upcoming performances. If you like this podcast, please take a moment to subscribe and write us a review on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. And we're pleased to announce we're now on Google Play as well. Thank you.